learned to read books when I was 4, or so my mother tells me. This is the first in a long line of book-related events in my personal childhood mythology. By first grade, I was hooked on my first big chapter books, the Little House on the Prairie series by Laura Ingalls Wilder. According to my mother, I was so enthralled with these books that I would stay up way past my bedtime, sneakily reading in bed until my wimpy mortal eyes betrayed me, and I'd fall asleep with a book on my face. Literally, a book tent on my face. I loved reading about spunky Laura and her simple prairie family. I loved that she was a tomboy who hated bonnets and dresses, just like me. Even as I grew older, I loved to follow along with the Ingalls family's migration across the country, perhaps because my family migrated a couple times, too. Time passed. I went to college, got busier, wrote papers, got jobs, didn't have much time for pleasure reading anymore. Then, a few years ago, I was reorganizing my bookshelves and came across my Little House books, still the same boxed set that I first loved when I was 7. It had been 10 or 15 years since I read them, and I decided it was time for the Ingalls and me to get reacquainted. But as I went to place Laura and her stories on my to-read pile, I noticed an interesting juxtaposition. Right next to my Little House books lay Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, an Indian history of the American West. Ding! A light bulb went on as I realized these two books happened at the same time. Although what I remembered about Laura's story was kind and fun-loving Pa, sibling love and rivalry, and the courtship of Laura and Almanzo, all of those beloved pioneer-enshrined events on the prairie happened during a largely unmentioned backdrop of Indian dispossession and genocide, black enslavement and migration, and even the Civil War. I decided that, while I would reread the Little House books, this time would be different. And so we began a project that spanned almost a year from conception to completion, in which I read the Little House novels in their historical context. I plotted the chapters of Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which proceed chronologically from 1838 to 1890, each focusing on a different Indian nation, and the books of Little House, which take place from 1866 to 1890, on a single timeline and added relevant historical events of the time. Then, since the Little House books are written for children, I searched for other historical children's novels to help fill in some of the gaps in the timeline. Here's the reading schedule I came up with. Yeah, I'm a bookworm, it's long. Thus began my Little House Wounded Knee project. Over the next months, I read my reading each week and blogged my thoughts and analysis before moving on to the next assignment. I began with my childhood nostalgia, still partially intact, but as the weeks progressed, I began to shift my perspective from my Eurocentric view of westward expansion to a view of history that faced east, as Dee Brown says in his book's introduction. Today, so much white nostalgia is focused on the good old days, when times were simpler and things were better. But as I discovered, the only reason these nostalgic white daydreams persist is because much of white America is ignorant of what the good old days were actually like. We reminisce about stories of our hardworking immigrant forebears, proud of their grit and perseverance. And it's not that they weren't determined or hardworking, but we are blisteringly unaware of the fact that our stories, the stories of white America, are told in total isolation, completely divorced from the concurrent stories of indigenous peoples, let alone black and brown immigrants, enslaved people, and settlers. Even from Laura Ingalls Wilder's very first book, Little House in the Big Woods, the disconnect is apparent. This book takes place a couple-hour drive from my house right here, so I did a little research to see where Laura's cabin in the woods was on the map. You can see that the Big Woods were already quite full of Native inhabitants. And yet the following, quote, is how Wilder begins book one in her Little House series. The great dark trees of the Big Woods stood all around the house, and beyond them were other trees, and beyond them were more trees. As far as a man could go to the north in a day, or a week, or a whole month, there was nothing but woods. There were no houses. There were no roads. There were no people. There were only trees and the wild animals who had their homes among them. This is literally the first page of the book. And already Wilder has erased at least 5 Indian nations and thousands of people from existence. Honestly, it kind of gave me whiplash. I could hardly believe the casual ease with which Wilder simply writes, "There were no people." I could feel the violence in that statement when I read it, because here's the truth behind that casual opening paragraph. The Dakota were tricked into signing away their lands, after which they were rounded up, starved, cheated, imprisoned in a camp, hanged in Mankato, bounty hunted for their scalps, and forced into a tiny barren reservation where many of them died before the survivors were legally expelled from the state of Minnesota, a law that is still on the books today. So there were people, but many were killed and relocated so that families like Laura's could be given free land. That all took place from about 1852 to 1863. Laura's older sister Mary was born in their Big Woods cabin in 1865, followed by Laura in 1867, which means the Ingalls were there no more than 2 years after the Dakota were forced out. That totally blew my mind. In 1867, Laura's birth year is the same year that the renowned Red Cloud and the Lakota were resisting white invasion and persuasion further west. And yet, none of this is mentioned, or really even alluded to, in Wilder's Big Woods. There is an enormous blind spot in how the story is being told, because the reader has no idea how the Ingalls got there. They're just there. As I continued through my reading list, I began to see these two narratives, that of the settler and that of the indigenous community, side by side. Where before I saw only the westward ho adventures of the intrepid Ingalls family, now I also saw the uprootedness and disconnection of the pioneer spirit embedded in the founding DNA of this country. I saw the entire story oozing with manifest destiny and the doctrine of discovery, treating the land as an empty place upon which European settlers improved. As Almanzo's father says in Farmer Boy, and I quote, "America is the biggest country in the world, and it was farmers who took all that country and made it America, son." I saw the parallels between the way settlers treated the indigenous peoples and the indigenous ecosystems, as alluded to when Almanzo explains to Laura about the tree claim on his homestead. "These government experts have got it all planned. They're going to cover these prairies with trees, all the way from Canada to Indian Territory. It's all mapped out in these land offices where the trees ought to be. They're certainly right about one thing. If half these trees live, they'll seed the whole land and turn it into forest land, like the woods back east." This quote spawned my next reading project, Imperial Geography, about the impact of white settlement on the land and ecosystems of Turtle Island. I also saw the violent disregard for indigenous humanity passed on in these children's books, from less obvious little things like constantly describing Indians as savage, wild, yelping, yipping, and terrible, to more apparent giveaways such as including the phrase, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian," no fewer than 3 times in a book whose protagonist is a 4-year-old. Side note, this phrase misquotes American Army General Sheridan, who originated the phrase when the Cheyenne survivors of 2 massacres cautiously approached his camp, identifying themselves as good Indians, to which Sheridan famously replied, "The only good Indians I ever saw were dead." As I delved deeper and deeper into the ugly, violent, and atrocity-filled history of American Indian removal, I began to be really angry at Laura Ingalls Wilder and the culture in this country that continues to think her books are good reading for children. These books are violent. They erase and dehumanize an entire culture. They persistently portray Indians as subhuman and savage, and they portray a blackface minstrel show as a jolly evening of entertainment. At first, I thought, no one should ever read these books. But the more I sat on it, the more I thought the opposite. Everyone, especially white Americans, should read these books with a critical eye. Because these stories of Ma and Pa and eking out a living on the wide open prairie are inextricably wound up in the mythology of this country. We still believe this country is founded on lofty ideals, even though it's actually founded on theft, murder, and slavery. We still believe that the mainstream white narrative is the truest and most important story. We still believe that we can make our country better by using and consuming the land, that we improve the land by our efforts. We still believe that the stories of Black, Brown, and Native communities are ancillary appendices that we can choose to leave out and not miss much. These are blatant and harmful lies. Mark Charles, a Navajo pastor, speaker, and blogger, often speaks of the need for a common memory before the people here in this land together can attempt reconciliation. And if white America is ever going to move forward in the effort towards racial justice and healing, we need to take a long, hard look at the stories we tell ourselves about the way things used to be. We need to mend the rift in the stories we tell, stitch back together the narratives of the settlers and the indigenous peoples, and look with honest eyes on the tall tales of our pioneer heritage. We need to let go of our nostalgia for a time that never was, and instead begin the process of undoing what we have done, of pulling up our stakes, of beginning to be unsettlers in a land not our own.